All right, well, here we go, and I guess I got to say it this way tonight. Buckle up, because the Torah portion is called Vayera, and it begins in chapter 18 of the book of Bereshit, or Genesis. And, you know, I've thought of this a lot over the last few weeks. Seems like every year we get into Genesis, and these first few Torah portions just have so much in them. It's probably the only time of the year when I really truly think, wow, I can see some value in the 3-year cycle. I like being able to go through the Torah in a year. It's kind of nice. But when we get to portions like Vayera, where there is so incredibly much in here that it feels almost like we got to just drop into warp drive and go in order to talk about all the stuff that's in the story. So simple way to introduce this is by saying, wow, there's just way too much in here for one parsha. But we will try to get through it and to do it justice, and that's the hardest part. But it begins like this. Chapter 18 begins, and Yahuwah appeared. Vayera elav Yahuwah unto him. By the terebinths of Mamre, as he, meaning Abraham, sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. So, and he appeared is the name of the portion. And what was it that follows? So we got a number of really interesting stories. This one, of course, is where three men come to visit Abraham. He sees them. He runs down from the tent door, bows down, and says, Adonai. If now I have found favor in your sight, don't pass away from your servant, I pray you. Let me get some stuff for you. Let's have a little water, wash your feet, recline yourselves under the tree, and I'm going to get you some bread. And then after that, you can move on. But here you have come to your servant. All right, they said, go do as you have said. So he goes to Sarah, and he says, make haste and get some measures of fine meal needed. Make some bread for our guests, well, actually cakes. And Abraham ran out to the herd himself. He got a nice, young, tender calf. He gave it to a servant and said, go dress this up. And he took some curd and milk and that calf that he dressed, and he set all of this before them. Now, you got to figure this is going to take a little while. He stood by him underneath the tree, and they all ate. Couple comments on this. Most of you've probably heard things like this before if you've been through the Torah portion and thought about it. Now remember, this is before the official giving of the written Torah to Moshe. So we know that. But we also understand, looking at people like Noah, and indeed a lot of things that are gonna be clear from the life of Abraham here. Abraham certainly understood a lot of what we would call the instruction of Scripture. He, in other words, knew a whole lot of things. But what's interesting is, it almost looks like what we got here is a, if you'll pardon the pun, a cheeseburger. He gets some curds, milk, and a calf. Now, you know that in traditional Orthodox Judaism, of course, this is not a kosher meal. You do not have milk and meat in the same meal. And this is one of those things, and I realize that, of course, the rabbis have an explanation. No surprise there. But anyway, this is one of those things that make me think that perhaps rabbinic understanding about mixing milk and meat at the same meal is not necessarily Torah. At least it wasn't so far as Abraham, or in fact, as it turns out, the emissary of the Creator himself would have understood. Anyway, what happens next is probably the most interesting part of, well, no, that's, I didn't want to say that. There's a whole lot of stuff that's interesting about this exchange. They ask him, where's Sarah? Well, she's over in the tent. And he said, now the King James capitalizes this. This does look like it is, in fact, the spirit of Yahuwah in the flesh. I will return to you when the next season comes around. And guess what? Sarah, your wife, will have a son. Turns out Sarah was, in fact, overhearing the conversation. We get a little parenthetic insert there. And Sarah laughed. Sarah literally laughed out loud. Now, the verse in between, the parenthetic insert, says, remember, Sarah and Abraham were both pretty well up there in years by this time, and it had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. In other words, she was postmenopausal. Sarah laughed, and she says, I'm really old. Am I going to have pleasure now with my Lord, who's also old? And now, for the first time, we see the Scripture actually address Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh as himself by name. And it says, "And Yahuwah said unto Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? Saying, is it really true, or is it of a surety that I, who am old, am going to bear a child? Do you really think anything is too hard for yours truly, for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh? At the set time, I will in fact return to you when the season comes around, and Sarah will have a son." "I didn't laugh," she said, because she was a little bit, I guess you'd say embarrassed, maybe even fearful at this point. "No," he said, "you really did laugh." The men rose up, they looked out towards Sodom, and Abraham went away, basically to help them on their path. And Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says something that is kind of interesting, almost like it's an introduction to further discussion. And I suspect he knew exactly what was going to happen, but it's always fascinating when you see how he allows these things to play out. "Shall I hide from Abraham the thing which I am fixing to do? Seeing that Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and all of the nations of the earth shall be blessed through him. For I've known him, to the end that he may command his children and his household after him, that they may keep the way of Yahuwah, to do righteousness and justice." And essentially, I'm going to bring upon Abraham all those things that have been spoken to him. But then he says, "Verily, the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great." And guess what? Their sin is exceedingly grievous. And of course, we probably have an understanding. Sodom obviously is known for the abomination that bears its name, a man lying with a man as with a woman. In that way, it's called sodomy. But clearly there are other things that went on in Sodom and Gomorrah too. We're going to see some of that in this very portion. Yahuwah says, "I'm going to go on down there now, and I'm going to see whether altogether they have done according to the things that I've heard tell, the cry of it, which has become known unto me. And if not, then I'll know that as well." So the men, all Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh plus the other two, turned. They went towards Sodom, but Abraham still stood there. And he drew near, and he said the following. Now this, to my mind, this is one of the incredible number of really fascinating exchanges in this Torah portion. And I will say this up front. As I have reread this and reread this over the years, find particularly amazing about this, and I think it really is something that we need as individuals to be able to cultivate, is both a fearful respect of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, but also the interesting ability that Abraham and David and Moshe and others had to dicker with him, to literally approach him as we would a friend. Certainly with reverence, but also with the kind of respect and the kind of interaction that he would like to have with us. Again, that's what I think is so really wonderful about this portion. "Hey," he says, "are you really going to sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Just suppose, peradventure is the old English word here, just suppose there might be 50 righteous folks within that city. Are you indeed going to sweep all of them away and not forgive the whole place for the 50 righteous that are therein? That would be unlike you," he suggests. "It's out of character for you to do this thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so the righteous would be like the wicked. This is far from you. Shall not the judge of the earth do justly?" Now, I suspect that the Creator probably suppresses the smile at this point. "All right, if I find 50 righteous men within the gates of Sodom, I'll forgive the whole place for their sake." And Abraham, he's pressing it at this point. "Behold, now I've already taken it upon myself to speak unto you, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and who am I but dust and ashes? So let me just kind of continue this line of reasoning here. Suppose that we're just 5 shy of that 50 number. Will you really destroy the whole city just because we're 5 short?" "Nope," he says, "I won't destroy it if there are in fact 45. And then he spoke one more time, and he said, "Perhaps suppose there should be 40. "Nope, I won't do it for the sake of 40. "Oh, let not Yahuwah be angry. I'll speak. I'm going to keep speaking. Peradventure, suppose there are 30. "If I find 30, no, I won't do it there. All right. Okay, I'm on a roll here. I've taken it upon me to speak unto Yahuwah. Suppose we find 20. Answer, no, I won't destroy it for the sake of the 20. Oh, he continues. One last shot, right? Let not Yahuwah be angry, and I'll speak just one more time. What if we find 10? I will not destroy it for the sake of the 10. Now remember, in the Hebrew understanding, you'll hear the term a minion, and a minion is in fact 10 folks. So if there's a minion of good folks, righteous, Zadokim found there, Sodom survives. That's the result of the dickering, the exchange, and of course this is probably one of the famous give and takes that we find in Scripture. Then it says, Yahuwah went on his way. As soon as he'd left off speaking to Abraham, Abraham returned to his place. And now we shift scene, Act 2. The two angels at this point, Malachim, messengers, come to Sodom. It's evening time. And here's Lot. He's sitting in the gate of Sodom. The sages say this would imply that Lot is a judge. And as a matter of fact, this is one of those things where you'll see a whole lot of sometimes I call it Kentucky windage, midrashim, speculation even, extra-biblical stuff, oral tradition, and so forth. It goes something like this. Why would Lot want to go to Sodom anyway? Well, maybe we see it here in this first verse, because he'd rather be a judge among people like the Sodomites than to be kind of second fiddle hanging around with Abraham. I'm not sure if I buy it, but at least it's an interesting observation worth speculating about, and it maybe does help to provide a little insight as we go through this. So again, understand, it's not something we can prove explicitly from Scripture other than the simple reference that you see here, but it does perhaps shed a little bit of light in context on Lot's character and some of the things we're going to see that otherwise would seem just kind of beyond the pale in what follows. All right, so Lot sees these folks. He rose up to meet him, fell down on his face, and says, Behold, my lords, turn aside you. Go on over to my place. Stay the night, wash your feet, rise up early, and then you can go on your way. Well, they said, no, we can abide here in the broad place all night. Oh, no, he says, come on over. So they turned into him. They did, in fact, enter his house. He made them a feast. He baked unleavened bread for them, and they all ate. But before they lay down, the fine folk of the city of Sodom, not exactly what you'd call brimming with righteous fellows, the men of the city encompassed the house, young and old, all the people from every quarter, and they called out to Lot, and they said unto him, Where are those fine-looking men? And I added that word in here, but you kind of get the impression at any rate. And yes, it does sound like explicitly what they're talking about is to know them in the biblical sense. The word is, the root there is used, to know them, yada. Bring them on out to us. We want to, know them. Lot went in. He shut the door. Actually, he went out, shut the door after himself. He's going to talk to them first. I pray you, my brothers, don't do this wicked thing. And instead now, and this is really one of the several kind of incongruous parts here, and it sounds like he's lying on several fronts. I got two daughters that have not known men. Yeah, they're virgins. Turns out later, we're going to find out they might just have husbands, so that's a little tough to believe. But the fact that he would offer his daughters to these scumbags is perhaps even more tough to believe. So, I pray you, let me bring those girls out to you. Do to them as you'd like. Only do these guests of mine, these men, do nothing, because they have come under the shadow of my roof. Stand back, they said. This one fella came to sojourn, and he wants to play the judge. They're talking about Lot. Let's just see. We'll deal worse with you than we will with them. And basically, they were fixing to move in on Lot, maybe even break down the door. But the men, the Malachim with inside, brought Lot back into the house. They shut the door, and they smote the men outside with blindness, great and small. So they worried themselves to even try to find the door. And at this point, they said to Lot, have you any here besides son-in-laws, your sons, your daughters? Anybody that you've got, bring them on out with us, and hurry, because we're going to destroy this place. The cry of them is waxed great before Yahuwah, and he has sent us here to destroy it. Lot went out. He spoke unto his sons-in-law, the ones who had married those supposedly virgin daughters, and he said, get out of this place. Yahuwah is fixing to destroy the city. But his son-in-laws basically thought he was laughing at them or kidding them or something. They didn't buy it. And it would apparently have cost them their lives. When the morning came, the angels, the messengers hastened Lot, and they said, come on, get on up. Take your wife, your daughters, the two of them that are here, lest you be swept away in the Torahlessness of this city. But he lingered. The men literally laid hold on his hands and his wife and the hands of his daughters. And if you want a picture, they dragged them out of the house because Yahuwah was being merciful unto them. So they brought him out and they set him outside the city. And it came to pass that once he had been taken abroad, that he was told, escape for your life. Do not look back. Don't stay out here on the plains. Go all the way to the mountains, lest you be swept away. And Lot said to them, oh, no, I don't want to do that. Behold, now your servant has found grace in your sight, right? You've magnified your mercy. You've helped me escape. I don't think I can make it all the way to the mountains, lest evil overtake me and I die. So, hey, how about a little city that's closer? This little one, can I go there and my soul shall live? And he said to them, see, I've accepted this thing concerning you also, that I will not overthrow the city of which you've spoken. So go there. The place was called Zoar. And when the sun was risen, Lot finally got to Zoar. And down comes the rain of brimstone, which is basically sulfur pellets, great big chunks of sulfur, and fire from Yahuwah out of heaven. Rained down on Sodom and Gomorrah, and he overthrew those cities, the plain, all of the inhabitants, everything that grew up out of the ground. And then it says the following. Now, I remembered seeing this as a kid, seeing the story, pictured poor Lot's wife turn around, and she turns into this little pillar of molten salt, right? When it rains, it pours. And I don't think that's exactly what we're talking. His wife, it says, looked back. And for that, she became, yeah, the English says a pillar of salt. The Hebrew word there actually might just seem to mean powder. And if you think of it this way, if you remove the water content from a human body, what's left is a little pile of powder. So I'm not saying that that's what happened, but at least when I picture it, can't argue that that might be what we're talking about here. It's interesting, though, that it's this idea of looking back. Now, it's not necessarily quite the same word. It's not teshuv. It's not turn around and go back. But it does seem to kind of have an implication that she looked back with some longing. Maybe. Maybe it was just that, her eyes beheld something and it was the mushroom cloud or whatever it was. Again, we're not sure. There'll certainly be no shortage of speculation on this point, but, it's an interesting observation. She became powder. We switch gears in the story for just a minute, and we turn to Abraham, who gets up early in the morning, and he went to the place where he'd stood before Yahuwah. He looks out on the plains towards Sodom and Gomorrah, the land of the plain, and behold! Now, I'll have to admit it. It says the smoke of the land went up as the smoke of the furnace, and yeah, okay, forgive me, I can't prove this, but when I read this, I can't help it either, I picture a mushroom cloud, right? What is going on here? If it rained fire and brimstone, that sounds more volcanic. Remember, brimstone sulfur is associated a lot of times with volcanism, and it doesn't sound like nuclear byproducts. We're not 100% sure in any case what happened. Lots of indications. If you've ever seen some of Michael Rood's stuff, he'll talk about taking people to the plains where Sodom and Gomorrah were. And you can still, to this day, you can see sulfur pellets, great big golf ball-sized even pieces of brimstone. They smell like sulfur. They crumble like sulfur. They are, in fact, if you've ever seen sulfur in a chemistry lab, they are almost pure sulfur. But in any case, Abraham sees it. When it came to pass, then, after the plain cities were destroyed, Elohim remembered Abraham. He sent Lot out of the midst of all of this when he overthrew the cities in which Lot dwelt. Lot then gets ready to go up out of this place that he wanted to stay for a while, Zoar. He goes up into the mountains, his two daughters with him. He was afraid to continue living in Zoar, so instead he dwelt in a cave, along with his two clearly not virginal daughters. And now we're going to see another one of these stories that to some extent, well, it sheds some light on the character of Lot, perhaps in more than one way. Most of the sages will tell you that Lot was a righteous man. While that may be true, and it's certainly true, you know, relatively speaking, compared to the fellows that were destroyed in Sodom and Gomorrah, well, all of the people that were destroyed in Sodom and Gomorrah, stories like this make you want to at least shake your head. So he's got two daughters, and both of them essentially get together and they say, you know, our dad's getting up there, and there is not a man in the earth, at least this is what they believe. What did they see in Zoar, I kind of wonder, to come into us? In other words, to lie down with us after the manner of, you know, the way they do things. So let's get our dad drunk. We'll ply him with wine, and we will, in fact, seduce him so we can preserve the seed of our father. So, first night, they make dad get drunk on wine. Firstborn gets on in there. She lays with her father, and it says he didn't know when she lay down nor when she arose. So Lot is essentially so out of it that he doesn't know he's committing incest with his daughter. Comes to pass, next morning, firstborn says to the younger, all right, tonight's your night. Let's get him drunk again this night also. Now you go in, you lie with him so we can preserve the seed of our father. Now at this point, I think it's fair to ask some questions, right? Lot's going to let this happen again? Was Lot really that out of it? Or is Lot just, he's playing dumb. He's just kind of saying, well, you know, if it happens, it happens. Hard to tell, folks. But something is clearly wrong. I guess that's the bottom line here. Thus, both daughters of Lot were pregnant by their father. And what we're going to see here is that in both cases, the two offspring from this act of incest of Lot with his daughters are going to have names that are going to be associated with places and with peoples and with, let's just say, negative stuff, to put it mildly. Firstborn had a son. His name was called Moab. You know the place. He is the father of the Moabites unto this day. And we know, of course, that lots of things are written about the Moabites. There is some redemption, but at least for 10 generations, the Moabites aren't allowed to enter into the temple and so forth. The younger daughter, too, she had a son. She called his name Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the children of Ammon, the Ammonites, on to this day. So you could kind of say we're 0-2 here. On to chapter 20. Abraham journeyed towards the land of the south. He dwelt between Kadesh and Shur and sojourned in a place called Gerar. And one more time, we're going to see what seems like an instant replay of a story that kind of, haven't we already seen this at least once? By the way, we're not done seeing it yet. Like father, like son, we're going to see it again. He goes into this land and he tells Abraham, Abraham says about his wife Sarah, well, she's my sister. And now we got Abimelech, king of Gerar. I guess Sarah's still a good-looking woman, even though she's getting up there. He sent for her, took her, lekach her. We can guess why, if it's not clear, and the terminology in the Hebrew makes it clear exactly what the intent is. But in this case, Yahuwah comes, actually it says Elohim, came to Abimelech, the king, in a dream. And they said to him, you know what? You are going to die because of the woman you have taken. She is, in fact, a man's wife. Now, it says here, Abimelech hadn't yet done anything wrong. He had not yet come near her, and he said, Yod Heh Vav Heh, you going to slay even a righteous nation? Doesn't that sound a little bit like a repetition of the dickering that we saw with Abraham? All right. And he continues. Look, didn't the guy tell me she's my sister? And she herself said, he's my brother. So in the simplicity of my heart and in the innocency of my own hands have I done this thing. Well, says Yahuwah to him in the dream, yep, I know that in the simplicity of your heart you've done this, and I also have withheld you from doing something that you would regret from sinning against me. So I suffered you not to touch her. So restore this man's wife. He is in fact a prophet. He will pray for you and you'll live. But if you do not restore her, know that of a surety you are gonna die. You and all of your people. And I like the Hebrew here too. This says mot to mot. Dying you shall die. The word mot is in there. In other words, it's not just you might die. It's no, dying you shall die. Let's just be real clear about this. You're dead, I say dead. Repeated. Dying you shall die. You and everybody that is yours. So Abimelech is not taking this lying down. He, in fact, rose up early in the morning, called his servants. He told these things to his servants, and the men were all basically scared to death. Abimelech then calls Abraham, said to him, "What have you done to us, dude? Wherein have I sinned against you that you brought on me and my kingdom all of this great sin? You've done things to me that shouldn't ought to be done. What have you? What did you see? What's the problem here? Oh, come on, tell me, why'd you do this?" And Abraham says, now this is an interesting way to put it. He says, "Because I thought to myself, surely the fear of Elohim is not in this place. And you all, yeah, I'm looking at you, you will surely slay me for my wife's sake. Moreover, hey, I really wasn't kidding. She is indeed my sister, daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother." In other words, we'd say she's a half-sister, and she did, in fact, become my wife. "So it came to pass, when Elohim caused me to wander from my father's house, and I said to her, 'Here's what you're going to do for me, please. It's a kindness you can show me. At every place that we come, say of me, he is my brother.'" So Abimelech isn't done yet. He took sheep and oxen, men servants, women servants. He gave all of these things to Abraham, and he restored Sarah, his wife, to him. And he said, "Behold, all of my land is before you. Dwell where you would like." To Sarah, he said, "Behold, I've given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is a covering of the eyes to all that are you with you and before all men you are righted." In other words, this is kind of a way of saying, I'm going to make things right for you. I'm going to restore your appearance in the sight of men. With silver, if nothing else. And verse 17 is truly fascinating. This is one of those places where a guy that I have always enjoyed reading about and seeing what his insight is in Scripture, Rashi has a comment on this one. It has to do with the Hebrew words here. And what I'm going to do as I read through the next few verses is conjugate them in the English the way he says that the Hebrew really claims they ought to be. And it's a subtle difference from what you're probably used to reading in the King James, but I suspect it's to me at least, it was a really insightful one. So it says, "Abraham prayed to Elohim." Abraham prayed to Elohim. "And Elohim healed Abimelech, his wife, and his maidservants, and all of them bore children. Because during this time that Abraham was sojourning there, Elohim, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, had in fact closed up the wombs of all of the house of the king because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. So nobody was having any children for however long this took to play out. But Abraham prayed unto Elohim." Okay, well, you might be thinking, so what? Chapter 21 starts this way. "And Yahuwah remembered Sarah as he'd said." And I'm going to put the Rashiism in here. He says that's not quite the proper way to conjugate the verbs here. What it really should say is, "And Yahuwah had remembered Sarah as he had said." In other words, at the point where 21 begins, chapter 21, Yahuwah had already remembered Sarah. He'd already made good on his promise. And he did unto Sarah as he had already spoken. Isn't it interesting? We see that Abimelech's house, his wife and his servants, their wombs had been closed. Now they're open. And behold, same thing had already happened to Sarah, as he had spoken. Now, Rashi's connection is the following. And, it is something that you can see within the Hebrew. And admittedly, it's a little bit of an interpretation. But I find this one to be particularly, kind of eye-opening. What he says is, notice the way this is phrased. Here's Abraham. Here is a king that has arguably taken his wife away. You might expect the guy to bear a grudge for this, but at least Abraham recognizes, no, it's his own fault in terms of what he has said, and nothing bad happened in this case. And then what? Abraham prays for somebody else, somebody who might even have nearly wronged him. He prays for Abimelech. And first, Abimelech and his house is healed. And then it says, at the point where we now resume the other part of the story, remember Sarah? She's been waiting for year after year after year. The promises have dragged out. They thought for such a long time that she was barren, that he was barren, that they weren't going to have any kids. And what's wrong with us? Why haven't we, right? And now the promise is given, and indeed, still, better part of a year, and we haven't seen it yet. But at the point where Abraham has already prayed for another fellow, the blessing that he prayed and that was revealed through the king and his house had already been visited upon Sarah, just as he had spoken. So essentially the Rashiism, the lesson that he draws is, here is another insight into this character of Abraham. As a matter of fact, it's the second time we've seen a glimpse into Abraham's character in this portion. Abraham prays for other people. And he prays for people that are pretty much what we would call scumbags, don't necessarily deserve it. His first intercession, one of the most, you know, famous in Scripture. He dickers on behalf of two cities that literally are synonymous with skullduggery, scumbaggery, and stuff that is not necessarily talked about in polite company. Sodomy. But he prayed for them. Tried to get them a reprieve. Just takes 10 honest, zodic, righteous people. Not that it was going to be found in Sodom, but nevertheless he tried. And finally, too, he prays for Abimelech. And it does say a whole lot about the character of this, the father of fathers. Well, Sarah conceived, and she bore Abraham a son in his old age, exactly as had been foretold. Abraham called the name of the son that was born unto him. Here's the same root word we've seen throughout the story. Abraham laughed, Sarah laughed, everybody laughs, and it's really now a time for joy. So the name of the child, laughter, joy, Yitzhak. And Abraham did what he also had been told, last Torah portion to do. He circumcised his son, laughter in the flesh, Isaac, when he was 8 days old, as he had been commanded by Elohim. And at the time where Abraham has his new son, he is a century old. He's 100 years old when Isaac was born to him. And Sarah says the following. I love this. Elohim has made laughter for me, and everyone that hears this story will laugh on account of me. Isn't that great? This is a wonderful story, and the essence of it is laughter. Things that you wouldn't think would ever happen, happen. And they're a bigger blessing than we would ever have imagined could possibly come to pass. If that's not worth laughing about joyfully, I'm not sure what is. Who would have thought, she says, who would have said unto Abraham that Sarah should give children suck? For I have borne him a son in his old age. Praise Yah. The child grew, was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. And now we see another reference, ironically, to laughter. But in this case, it's a demeaning, mocking kind of laughter, or perhaps even a colloquial expression for something that's worse still. Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian. We don't see his name being used here, interestingly, right? son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she'd borne unto Abraham, making sport, mocking. And yes, the language does seem to have a very clear sexual reference here. What was Ishmael doing with Isaac? It's not clear, but whatever it was, it really upset the whole crowd. So, she, Sarah, says to Abraham, send this woman the heck out of here. She will not be heir with my son, with Isaac. And this thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight on account of his son. Whatever it was, this mocking, this derisive, this perhaps, and this verse 11 seems to say, yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. Whatever it was nasty, and Abraham agreed. Get him out of here. So, Elohim said to Abraham, do not let it be grievous in your sight because of the lad and because of the bondwoman. In all that Sarah has said, nevertheless, listen to her, hearken unto her, Shamar, for in Isaac your seed will be called. And not, don't forget, in the seed of the bondwoman, I'm also going to make a nation because he is your seed as well. So Abraham got up early in the morning. He took bread and a bottle of water. He gave it to Hagar, put it on her shoulder along with the child, who by this time, of course, is more like a young man. He sent her away. She departed straight into the wilderness of Beersheba. And in the bottle was enough water to go a ways, but evidently not far enough. She put the child under one of the shrubs when the water was gone, and she sat down a goodly ways off, like a bow shot away, and said, I don't want to see the death of my son. She lifted up her voice, and she wept. And Yahuwah, it says, and by the way, this is exactly as promised. He will hear. He did. He heard the voice of the lad. And the messenger, the angel, the Malak of Elohim called unto Hagar from out of the heavens, and she said, what's the problem here, Hagar? Do not fear, fear not, for Elohim has heard, as promised, the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, get the lad, hold him fast by the hand, I indeed will make of him a great nation. And at this point, Elohim opens her eyes. She sees a well of water. She went, filled up the bottle, gave the lad some drink, and well, they all at least lived not quite happily ever after, but things went reasonably well. Elohim was with the lad. He grew. He dwelt in the wilderness, and he became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran. His mother took him a wife out of the land of Egypt, and it came to pass that about that time, oh, this guy, we've heard him before, Abimelech. He's going to come back into the story. Phicol, captain of his host, spoke to Abraham, and he said, you know what? Elohim seems to be with you in everything you lay your hand to. So, swear to me, if you will, please, here by your God, that you will not deal falsely with me, nor with my son, nor my son's son, but I'm going to do some kindness, and I already have done kindness to you, and so in accord with that, you shall do unto me, and to the land that you have been sojourning in. All right, says Abraham, I can do that, I'll swear. And Abraham reproved Abimelech, because of that well that his servants had violently taken away. Well, I don't know who's done this, says the king. You didn't tell me about it either, but I did hear about it today, so we'll take care of it. Abraham took sheep and oxen, he gave them to Abimelech, and they made a covenant. They made a covenant. Now, here's another one of those places where I'll simply point out, the Midrash says, because there's a reminder in the book of Joshua and before, make no treaty with the inhabitants of the land. This is what Moshe is told. And the treaties that are made with the people of the land do come back to cause problems. Whether or not that is one of the instructions that Abraham should have known better about is not clear. I don't see it as clear. However, you will see in the Midrash that this was something that supposedly caused problems. And whether it's true or not, they'll make the claim that well, other things, like even the Akedah we're going to see about in the next chapter, were a result of this treaty. Again, I don't necessarily buy it. Abraham set 7 ewe lambs out by themselves. What do you mean by these? He says, well, these 7 ewe lambs shall take, you'll take hold of my hand, and all of this is for a witness unto me that I am the one who have digged this well. Let's not have any more well water issues. It's kind of like the water wars out west that people are aware of. This, in fact, is a witness. This is my well. Therefore, the place was called Be'er Sheba, and that means seven, and well, because they swore both of them. So, basically, Abimelech rose up, Phicol, the captain of his host, and they went back to the land of the Philistines, and Abraham planted a tamarisk tree there, and he called on the name of Yahuwah, the everlasting Elohim, and he sojourned in that land for quite a while. Which brings us to one of the other most famous stories in Scripture, almost the end of the Parsha. And this one, literally, and maybe we'll talk about it in more detail on tomorrow. Incredible story. Not incredible as in not credible, incredible as in, yes, it certainly does look prophetic. Yes, it has all kinds of things that kind of tear at our hearts. And yes, I cannot go through this story without saying, to my mind, it shows a level of faith in Abraham that we need to aspire to. A lot of folks will take a look at this story and say, oh, this is a bad thing. There is Midrash, as I mentioned, about all kinds of comments on here. One of the things you will hear is, hey, it seems like Sarah disappears after this story. Maybe Sarah and Abraham had a big falling out. You did what with my son? You did what? You took him up where and you were going to do what? I don't know. That's an argument from silence. Scripture doesn't tell us any of that. But what it does tell us is plenty. And yeah, I'm going to connect some dots. There might be a little bit of Markology in here, at least in terms of my understanding of what Abraham was possibly feeling. But I'm going to suggest that at least the bottom line is undeniable from what is written here. So let's go through the story. Came to pass after these Deborim, these words, these things, that Elohim tested, proved, maybe even provoked Abraham. That word there, Nisa, tested. That's probably the way I'd like to see it, tested Abraham. And he said unto him, Abraham! Response, right? Everybody's heard this word. If not, this is a great time to learn it. Hineni. Abraham? Yeah, here I am. Hineni. Hineni! I'm over here. Another way to put it is, I am here. Here am I. It's a response that's kind of like, you know, when a captain says to the troops, I need a volunteer. Hineni! I'm here! Call on me! And he says, take your son, your only son whom you love, even Yitzhak, and get up into the land of Moriah and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains that when you get there, I will tell you of. Very next verse. And we don't see a response. We don't see dickering from Abraham. He dickered for the lives of the men of Sodom and Gomorrah. Isn't it interesting? Now, again, I'm not going to try to make an argument from silence other than the following. This guy dickered for the lives of a bunch of scumbags, my term, in Sodom and Gomorrah. And yet he's told, get your son, take him up into the mountains and kill him. And he doesn't say a word. No dickering. Hey, how about if I can find, 10 things that he's done? No, none of that. Why? I can't tell you why. I can't tell you what he did or didn't say. Again, Scripture is silent. But in my mind, it's a silence that speaks volumes. Because it's a theme I'm going to keep coming back through throughout this story here. I don't think Abraham doubted for a second that what was going to happen up there was not going to result in the destruction of the promises that he knew full well that this God who had been with him all of these years and offered him miracle and laughter wasn't going to make good on. I don't think the man ever had any doubt about it. So my understanding of the silence, again, Markology, if you will, the way I would look at it is, if I'm in Abraham's shoes, I like to put myself in and say, what would I be feeling? What would I be thinking if I had the level of faith and obedience, may we all, that this guy Abraham had? I'm probably thinking something along the lines of, wow, this is an unusual request, but isn't this gonna be interesting to watch? Because he knows. One thing he knows for sure. My promised seed comes through Isaac. I don't know how he's going to do it. Maybe he resurrects it. Maybe he beams him up. I don't know, but I'm thinking this is going to be something to behold. Okay? Silence, though. Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his ass, took two of his young men with him, along with Isaac. They got themselves some wood for the burnt offering. They rose up and they went to the place that he'd been told to go. It took a couple of days, and on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes. He saw the place in the distance, and he said to his young man, "Y'all stay here with the ass, and the lad and I will go up yonder, and we will worship, and we will come back to you." Do you see it? He's not lying to him. "We're going to go on up there, going to worship, come back to you." Abraham took the wood, he laid it upon Isaac, his son. He did what? Now let's read this next slowly. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, and he laid it upon Isaac, his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife, and then they both of them went together. So he's got Isaac carrying the wood. He takes the fire and the knife. They're all heading up the hill, both of them together. And Isaac asks his dad a question. Says, "Hey, my father." "Hey, Nanny, here I am, my son. Well, look, here's the fire. Here's the wood. Where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Now, you've heard this phrase before. I find the phrase amazing. It does read similarly, almost identically, in fact, in both Hebrew and in English. And yes, there is some double entendre here. Yes, it certainly sounds like a prophetic utterance. "Elohim will provide himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son." So, it says, they went both of them together. The two of them walked together. Abraham, the father, is telling his son, we would say the God's honest truth. And he will, and he did. And you can read that in any number of ways. But picture the situation if Isaac is thinking, "You're going to do what? You're going to kill me up there? Am I going to go voluntarily through with this?" I think the father and the son both share a level of faith and understanding here. And it has to be that way, because Isaac goes along willingly. As a matter of fact, the two of them walked off together. They came to the place that Elohim had told him of. Abraham built an altar there. He laid the wood in order, and he bound. Here comes the terminology that's used. You'll hear this story referred to as the Akidah, or some would say the Akidah, the binding. He bound Yitzhak, his son, and he laid him upon the altar on top of the wood. Again, look at the story. This has to be voluntary. How else could it possibly be? The son allows himself to be bound and laid upon the wood. "Hey, Dad, this is going to be pretty neat, isn't it? I don't know how it's going to work out, son, but wow! Stay with me here. This is going to be cool. Trust me." And he did. Abraham stretched forth his hand. He took the knife to slay his son. Now, I think probably the biggest question in my mind as I have read this over the years and thinking to myself, not only how is this going to play out, but I tend to suspect he's got the knife in his hand. He really intends to follow through here. The son is probably thinking, I wonder how much this is going to hurt. And the father's probably thinking, I wonder how much this is going to hurt my son. But if I follow through on this, then what we're going to see is a resurrection. He's going to have to be made whole again somehow. That might be even neater. I don't know. But again, Abraham is simply walking it out in obedience, in utter faith that the promises that he has been made will play out one way or another. And he's not exactly sure how, but he's fixing to find out. At this point, the Malach, the angel, the messenger of Yahuwah, calls out to him from the heavens and says, "Abraham, Abraham," not once, twice. Response, same words we're starting to learn. "Hineni, I'm here. Don't lay your hand upon the lad, nor do anything to him." Pause. Abraham has the knife in his hand. I think at this point, if you will, what we would say is the die is cast. There is a point at which it is clear beyond all shadow of a doubt that Abraham, the man, fully intends to walk in obedience. He's not just going through the motions. He has made the decision. "I'm doing it. I'm really doing it. I'm going through with it. And now we'll see how it plays out." And at that point, he hears it. Abraham, Abraham, Hineni. Don't lay your hand upon the lad, nor do anything to him. Now I know that you are in fact a man who fears Elohim, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. The son of promise, if you will, the one that you have been told, your line, your seed, will be a blessing to all of the earth via. Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there's a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. So he went and got the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the stead of his son. It is literally a replacement. And I look at this, I get a little nerdy here. I'll try not to be too nerdy for too long. But in so many things we see in the physical universe and in Scripture, there is a balance. A physicist, an engineer, will talk about conservation of mass energy. We'll talk about conservation of momentum, conservation of kinetic energy. You watch a pool ball hit another pool ball, right, on a pool table. And if it's done head-on and perfectly, it's a fully elastic collision. One ball stops dead, all the energy is transferred to the other ball, it moves on. It is literally a replacement of one object for another with all of the original characteristics, the momentum, the kinetic energy preserved. In other words, when it's all said and done, the equations balance. That's the way I look at this situation. The ram is offered in the stead of his son, the equations balance. Guess what? We're going to look at the rest of the creation. We're going to look at all kinds of things having to do with life and death and the sacrifice of the son, your only son. And we're going to see that in so many ways, the equations balance. Now, that's me as a nerdy engineer. In other words, looking at a lot of these things in Scripture and saying, yeah, that's the way he's made the world. The equations balance. And one way or the other, our Creator is smart enough. He knew the end from the beginning. He has figured out a way for the equations to balance in spite of the fact that we have a tendency as well as a talent for screwing things up massively. Abraham called the name of that place Yahuwah Yireh, as it is to this day said, in the mount, the Har, where Yahuwah is seen, Yireh. Yahuwah Yireh. And the second time, the same Malach calls to Abraham out of the heavens, and he said, by myself have I sworn, says Yahuwah, because you have done this thing. You've not withheld your son, your only son, that in blessing I will bless you, that in multiplying I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand upon which is the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your seed shall all of the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have shamared, you hearkened, you heard and obeyed my voice. So, Abraham, well, he did exactly as he had told the young men truthfully, the ones that were waiting down there with the ass, that he was going to do. Went back, they rose up, they went together to Beersheba. Abraham dwelt there. And it came to pass after this, we're going to get some updates on the family back in the Northland. It was told to Abraham, look, Milcah, she has borne children to your brother Nahor, Uz, firstborn, Buz, his brother, Kemuel, father of Aram, Chesed, Hazo, Pildash, Yidlaf, and Bethuel. Why are we hearing all of this? Well, if we think about it, it's going to be important in about two Torah portions. This is going to be the genealogy of the woman that will later come to marry and be the wife. We're talking about Rivka, of course, of Isaac, your son, your only son, in the story that we just see concluded. Bethuel, it says, begot Rebekah. These eight did Milcah bear to Nahor, Abraham's brother, and his concubine, whose name was Rumah. Also she bore Teba, Gaham, Tahash, and Maakah. And that takes us to the end of literally a remarkable portion with a whole lot of information. And I guess with that, I'll say we still have some other things to talk about this evening, and there's a lot of information there, but again, what an incredible, literally, foundation. It's a rock upon which so much of the rest of Scripture is built.